What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Happy Halloween, everyone.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, Gabe.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, Leslie. Happy Halloween,
Thank
listeners.
You.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper, and I'm joined by...
Hello for the spooky Halloween episode of the Katie Halper Show. This is Gabe Pacheco.
Gabe Dracula.
Gabe, the crypt keeper.
Crypt keeper.
The grave robber.
Grave robber, cradle robber. No, not so much. No, I went there, but yeah. He's not.
That's like a real life monster.
Crime.
We're not going to
yeah, exactly.
end crime. We're going to stick to the fantasy today.
Yeah. And we have as our guest, Leslie Monster Lee. I don't know. I'm trying to throw in some spookiness in there, but Leslie Lee.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on again, Katie.
Of course, yeah. And Leslie is the co-host of Struggle Session, which is a great podcast.
Yeah, they just got t-shirts coming out, too.
Oh, nice.
I saw that on Twitter. So congrats, yeah. guys.
Yeah, patreon.com/strugglesession, prowrestlingtees.com/strugglesession. We got everything you need out there.
Great. You got mugs? We got mugs. You guys gotta get mugs and we gotta get t-shirts. I was just thinking that we need t-shirts.
That's right. Let's get this the aesthetic out there.
Yeah, we're gonna have some vape pens coming out probably. I think our listeners are more vapers than coffee drinkers.
Oh, got it. I'm a real coffee addict.
On the East Coast, man, we're over here just chewing Vivarins. Don't sleep.
Just stay up all night watching Halloween movies.
That's right. I'm putting Nodos in my Lucky Charms. I'm eating those late at night, trying to watch as many horror movies as possible before October 31st.
Or after, depending on when we release this. The week of. We like to watch them the week of. But let's talk first about Halloween costumes. You guys grew up seeing any like offensive costumes. Have you ever encountered any?
I've never had my feelings hurt by costumes I've seen in real life, but I've always grown up in cities. So, you know... I wonder where,
right?
You know, this happens.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
I think in a city you're going to get checked pretty quickly if you go out there and you're wearing something like explicitly
right.
offensive.
What about you, Leslie?
So funny story. So if anybody remembers being online around maybe 2003, 2004, and like the first wave of articles like calling out white people for how they dress. There was probably you might have seen a piece or maybe just an image post of white people at a party trying to dress like ghetto.
Yeah.
I know all those people from like that first round of stuff. It was a party, I think in New Orleans or Baton Rouge, where they would dress up like as, you know, ghetto black people. And I knew all those people.
You mean you literally knew these people? Like, or
no,
you
yeah,
know
oh.
these types of people?
No, literally knew the people who were in like that first, in when the early waves
expose.
Of calling this stuff out. Yeah, I literally knew these people, hung out with these people, party with these people. Some of these people were actually my friends. back in my DJ and rave days.
So
and,
what, do you remember any of these like offensive costumes or did you block them out?
It would just be like, what would a white person in like 2001 would think is stereotypically black? There was nothing creative about it. It was just like dressing like whatever the rappers of the time dressed like. That was big. Maybe the rappers of 3 years ago, because, you know, some they were a little bit behind in the times, but yeah. And they were really shocked at the attention they got and a little bit hurt and offended. They didn't understand. They thought they were just celebrating black culture.
Halloween and culture.
And they just didn't get it, didn't understand. Even a couple of years later, it was like, because they would do the party like annually. It would be like a, I forget what they call it. It wasn't literally a dress up like that people party, but it was, they call it, they had some, you know, clever punny name for it, and they would have it annually until like this article happened and they were like, okay, I guess we can't do that anymore, because they would post the pictures online and like it's fun and stuff like it, like any other party. I don't know if people, if kids these days know anything about the rape scene, but a big thing was every party people would go around, take a bunch of photos and then post them all online.
Hell well, yeah.
And those photos would make their way around, and these photos made their way around, and people got a little bit pissed off at them for it.
So were ravers like social media like trailblazers?
Oh yeah,
I didn't know this.
1,000%. Every single social media movement, ravers were first on, until strangely enough, Twitter. Ravers never really got to Twitter for some reason.
Well, is it
you can even.
Yeah, I feel like because raving isn't the most literary
genre
subculture, you know?
Right.
Yeah, but message boards, live journal, MySpace, oh, huge with the rave scene. Yeah, even and even Facebook too. Big, big, big with ravers. None of the ravers understood Twitter, unfortunately.
Or wokeness.
No, they did not understand wokeness. It was just about peace, love, unity, respect. And so if you ever actually talked openly about things like racism, you were kind of just harshing everyone's vibe, dude. Because I was a black raver, one of the few, and like I would always talk about, you know, how racism is bad. Like I could have spared these people this online embarrassment they're facing. Some of them have pretty good jobs now, so I hope no one goes digging back and finds some of this stuff.
Wow.
With them, you know, dressed up like hood with like tinfoil under their teeth for, you know, to show that they have, you know, gold fronts, right, or whatever.
Grills,
right? Is there a link to this, by the way?
Oh, I don't know if it might not still be up. It was like 15 years ago, which is like 100 years in internet time. You probably need like an internet archaeologist in order to find it. It was on the message boards that the little raver message board we had. It was a long, long time ago.
What years were you going to raves?
Oh, so 2000 to, I guess I want to say 2007, but I feel like it was really died down back then. You couldn't really call them raves anymore.
I think I was going in like 96, 97, 98. And then, and that was like right when the Plur started erupting as a sort of a reaction to too many altercations on the dance floor, mostly over drugs.
Yes. Yeah, lots of pretty much all the drama around it. There was tons of drama in the rave scene, believe it or not, usually involving drugs, relationships. You bring all those things together at like 3 a.m. in the old theater and just shit happens.
But I think you're right about the early adopting with technology. I'd love to see a collection of like a book of all of the old flyers for for parties, because I feel like that's where everyone learned their graphic designing.
Yes, absolutely.
And those early flyers all look like screensavers or
The 3D graphics all twisted up. And
sometimes people don't get the cultural appropriation stuff, that it goes in one way and not the other. So they'll do this false equivalence. They're like, can a black person not be James Bond, or can a black person not be Mozart? But I don't think anyone's ever been like offended or problematized a black person being Mozart, because there's not like a lot of Mozart phobia.
And yeah, and also black people generally don't put on white face to dress up as a white character. They just put on the costume. Like, you can dress up as a black, you know, character or celebrity, just, you know, don't wear blackface, which apparently Megyn Kelly on her NBC show was defending wearing blackface.
This year, the costume police are cracking down like never before.
But, well, what is racist? Because truly, you do get in trouble if you are a white person who puts on blackface on Halloween, or a black person who puts on whiteface for Halloween. There was a controversy on The Real Housewives of New York with Luann, as she dresses Diana Ross, and she made her skin look darker than it really is, and people said that that was racist. And I don't know, I felt like, who doesn't love Diana Ross? She wants to look like Diana Ross for one day. I don't know how, like, that got racist on Halloween.
On the Today Show, like, she forgot that she wasn't on Fox News anymore. Just like NBC forgot that she was a white supremacist when they hired her.
There's so many out there, yeah.
Well, I think we're going to have this war every single year so we can dust off the same top 10 list of white people appropriating a different culture and making an offensive costume. Just like for every year moving forward, we're going to have a war on Christmas. This is going to be the war on white people wearing sombreros.
You can't wear anything Mexican-based. No sombrero, no maracas.
Oh, yeah. Gabe, how do you feel about sombreros?
I could care less.
You had a great costume, by the way. Were you Wes Craven? Is that what it was as a little kid?
I was Freddy Krueger every year for like 5 or 6 years.
Really?
Which is ironic because Freddy was such a beloved character among children. Yet he is the ultimate predator of children. Mm. So he's a child killer, but for whatever reason,
Stockholm syndrome.
We loved him. We loved him so much.
Yeah, I couldn't get enough. I understand how prophecy works, or when somebody comes back, like in religions, when somebody comes back down from the mountain with a special message from the Lord, because that's kind of like the first kid in elementary school whose parents let them watch rated R movies.
Yeah.
Because that kid comes back to school on a Monday morning and says, "You wouldn't believe what I saw. There's a character.
Yes.
He comes in your dreams. He was burned alive, and his name is Freddy." And as a child, you're like, what? Tell me more. And you fill in the blanks and you kind of create this myth that's even bigger than the film could possibly be, just hearing secondhand the story.
Oh, hell yeah. I still remember conversations when I was 5 about hearing about Terminator or Predator, all this stuff we weren't supposed to watch before we saw it. And then I would just wait till it hits like HBO and watch it.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so good.
And I think that oral tradition is still alive and well. And the bards that keep that alive for us are our children in kindergarten, first grade, and second grade that come from broken homes or are latchkey kids. And it's better than the films themselves, is the mythology that you get to build around them before you see them.
Yes.
Did you improve your Freddy Krueger costume, or was it just like a solid?
It was
same. Like, did every year you have it more flair, or you like understand the character on a deeper level?
I kept the glove in a nice stained oak wooden box,
nice
with a felt interior, and then I would just pull it out from under my race car bed every year, dust it off, open it up, and put that little plastic bladed glove back on.
Did your parents like it? Were they scared? Did they think it was cute? Was it like a purge? Actually, we can get to the purge thing, but was it like catharsis?
They thought it was fun, but I have to say, my first experience with horror movies was when we got our first VCR, and my mother was very left-leaning, and I wanted to rent a Chuck Norris movie, like Invasion USA, and she said, no, you can't watch any of these jingoistic, violent films that are sort of where America is good and imperialist.
US exceptionalism and all that.
American, do you hear me? I want to talk to you. American, I want to negotiate. Do you hear me, American?
Loud and clear.
All that. So I said, okay, well, how about I get this Nightmare on Elm Street? And the only one they had was part 2.
Mm.
So I'm like 7 years old. And she's like, that's a movie that's a fantasy. No problem.
Right.
So little did any of us know how sort of mind warping Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2 will be for a 7-year-old boy.
It sounds so family funnish. Nightmare on Elm Street.
Someone is coming back to Elm Street. He is not friendly.
He is not patient.
Get off of me!
And he is not a welcome visitor.
No! No! No!
But he has something terribly special for the new kid on the block.
Dad! Help!
Daddy can't help you now.
Freddy Krueger is back on Elm Street. Watch out for him. He'll be in your neighborhood soon. A Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 2.
You are all my children now.
Freddy's Revenge.
So that was, and that was my entry to Freddy as well. It wasn't the first film, it was the second one, which is an amazing, surreal exploration of homosexuality through the lens of horror. So it's all about coming out and
what do I have to do to make you understand me?
The fears of what's inside of us.
Fred Krueger, he's inside me and he wants to take me again.
And homophobia and
something is trying to get inside my body. Yeah, and she's female and she's waiting for you in the cabana and you want to sleep with me.
So I didn't get all of these subtle.
Not until 8. The first year.
I hadn't taken my gender studies classes yet in elementary school. We hadn't upgraded to that, so I wasn't quite aware. I just knew that everything in this movie was challenging everything that I knew.
Right. It'd be funny if like you're sitting in your college like class sociology and at Bard or whatever, and like a light bulb goes off in your head. You have a flashback of something from a Nightmare.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, coming out of the closet. It's just like Freddy bursting out of this guy's body and. Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2.
I have to say I'm like I feel like a philistine when it comes to horror movies and science fiction films. But for whatever reason, it takes me a lot to enjoy something that has any fantasy built into it. I respect them. I know that they're smart, right? I know Ray Bradbury is very smart and very political. With science fiction, there's like a lot of room for critique because you can say things that won't get you censored because you're talking kind of in code. Or you make it more accessible when it's science fiction. If you wrote a book or made a movie that was like, the current president is evil and locking people up in jails for not doing anything, censors wouldn't like it. People would maybe find it too disruptive, if you will.
Right.
But if you do it in like another land or a magical land or in the future, it seems more permissible.
I think fantasy, sci-fi, and horror, basically any genre type story has that advantage of it kind of gets past certain people's walls,
right?
Because they're coming in not really expecting a message, and so that makes it easier to deliver one. In horror, you can talk about issues that you can't talk about in other movies, like as Gabe was just talking about Nightmare on Elm Street two, all very, you know, for lack of a better term, gay film, but it was a mainstream sequel to a mainstream movie that was a hit. That wasn't something that, you know, was really happening. Like the second Indiana Jones wasn't like a gay version of Indiana Jones, but Nightmare on Elm Street was, because it was even like further into that, you know, genre thing, where people weren't really expecting a message, so they didn't, you know, put their walls up. They weren't saying you can't say this in this kind of film because it's for kids or for everybody. Like, no, they could kind of do what they want with it.
You know what's funny? Speaking of like not expecting stuff or like going by very strict definitions, in Spain under Franco, there was censorship, obviously. And they had this famous example of a movie where a man and a woman were having an affair and they didn't want that. So they turned them into brother and sister. So it went from like adultery to incest, kind of.
So it got more extreme?
It got more extreme, but I guess kind of more Catholic. Less like family challenging or something. Less family values. They kept in the family at least.
But I always feel like if somebody tells me this is a very important film and you need to see it,
right,
so it's going to be viewed by the Academy and rated in that way, then it's probably a super milquetoast movie that just replicates and supports the current status quo. And with something like horror or when it's schlocky, or when it's dismissed by the Academy, that's when it actually has the cover, the darkness, right, where it can be important, and it can actually reach the masses.
Yeah, did you guys see the movie Three Kings with Mark Wahlberg and Ice Cube and George Clooney? Did you guys see that?
I've seen it on like TNT before. I don't know how much attention I paid to it, but it has pretty good politics.
It does. And I think it has good politics in a way that like aren't too explicit.
What is your rank, bro?
Sergeant First Class, 437 Civil Affairs Company, U.S. Army Reserve.
My man, tell me something, okay? What is the problem with Michael Jackson?
What do you mean?
What is the problem with Michael Jackson, the king of pop?
Woohoo, hee-hee.
It is so obvious. A black man made the skin white and the hair straight, and you know why?
No.
You sick fucking country make the black man hate himself just like you hate the Arab and the children you bomb over here.
I don't hate children.
Kind of humanizes Iraqis, and of course I'm setting a low bar because that shouldn't be radical politics, but sadly it is.
Do they care, buddy?
Does who care?
Do you army care about the children in Iraq? Do they come back to help?
No, they're not coming.
You bomb my family, do you know that? You blow up my home, the Wall Street. My wife is crushed by a big fucking block of concrete. She lose her legs. Dog legs cut off now.
That's horrible.
Oh my God, buddy, I didn't even tell you the horrible part yet. My son was killed in his bed. He is 1 year old. He is sleeping with his dad when the bomb come.
I have a daughter.
Very nice for you, bro. She's safe without the bomb, the concrete, and all this shit. How old is she?
1 month old.
What's her name?
Crystal.
What make you decide to tell me about Crystal, my man?
Oh, because we're both fathers.
I'm not father no more, do you remember? My son is dead now. Can you think how it feel inside your heart if I bomb your daughter?
Worse than death.
That's right. Worse than death.
But I always think that like that's such a good thing to do, because we can all see an art house movie that challenges race and presents it as a social construction. But that'll be in like 12 theaters, like if you're lucky, around the entire world and universe and galaxy, you know, and like a very popular movie like this, I think can obviously do really well. But
I think The Purge is a good example of what we just recently talking about, because they've done four movies now and a TV series of explicitly anti-racist, anti-capitalist, anti-status quo films that people are just watching and absorbing, and they all have been successful without like a backlash to it, because they are able to, you know, dress it up in this horror conceit where, what if one night crime was legal?
Tonight allows people a release for all the hatred and violence that they keep up inside them.
It is a night that is defining our country.
Citizens, this will be a tradition we celebrate every year. Join the first purge.
People are now calling this controversial experiment of legalized crime the purge.
Do not purge!
Do not purge!
This is your emergency broadcast system announcing the commencement of the first purge.
Our neighborhood is under siege from a government who doesn't give a shit about any of us.
At the siren, all crime, including murder, will be legal for 12 hours. All emergency services will be suspended. Your government thanks you for your participation.
And they really do another clever thing too. Like, they advertise the movies as kind of these right-wing fantasies, like, which is like, you know, kind of baseline for America. I don't even want to say right-wing fantasies, because I feel like liberals kind of have to believe this sort of thing too, where, you know, if we didn't have the police, if we didn't have prisons, then crime would just run amok and we would have all be out for themselves. And these movies say, no, 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 that's not the case. Most people, especially poor people, explicitly poor Black and Latino people, if we did not have the police or the prisons, like the worst thing we would do is like throw block parties, right? that's the crime that is what's happened. And that's the crime that everyone does when without, you know, government intervention. Right. But in the Purge films, what happens is that the ruling party starts throwing these purges, and then nobody does any violence. Nobody wants to purge.
Right.
And they want the purges to happen to eliminate the lower classes.
Yeah. So can you set up you have this great piece called In Reality, Every Night is Purge. It was at Truth Dig. Can you just set up for people what the plot is for people who haven't seen it? Spoiler alert, you're going to hear it.
Also, if you haven't seen it, Wikipedia and reviews on YouTube
really
exist.
Gabe really is not like when we handhold for our audience. But
yeah, so basically the premise of The Purge is that once a year in America for one night, all crime is legal. You can do whatever you want. No police will stop you. You are not held accountable. And they do this ostensibly because they feel like there's a psychological value to it. They say that it helps reduce crime. It's good for people to purge. They can get out all their negative emotions in one night and then go and spend the rest of the year as good citizens. And the films really explore, so what does this actually mean for people? Well, it means first thing is if you're rich, you're going to spend a bunch of money on high power weapons and bunkers and just laying your house out. So you don't have to worry about anybody attacking you on Purge night. You're fine. You're good. And in the first film, it follows a family who he sells these security systems to the neighborhood. And he's a supporter of the Purge. He believes in this, you know, ideology behind it, even though he doesn't participate in it, but he can protect himself. But what ends up happening is that a homeless Black man who ends up being the moral center of the film, it's a positive betrayal of a homeless person in the film, which you almost never see outside of, you know, sentimental narratives. He's a homeless Black man, and he becomes kind of the heart of the film because the family, he lets him in while the homeless Black fan is being attacked and chased by these white prep school kids, these rich people, rich kids. And the rich kids tell the protagonist, played by Ethan Hawke, that, you know, we don't want to hurt your family, but it's our right to kill this Black man and beat him up. And he had the audacity to fight back. So you have to let him out or you're going to be accountable too. And it's kind of that cat and mouse between them. But the main thing is, it's like, When people first heard about the Purge film, they assumed that it was going to be just this, you know, right-wing fantasy that if, you know, we didn't have laws, we didn't have cops, everybody would just kill each other. But that's not what they said. They said if we didn't have laws, we didn't have cops, rich people would just kill the poor. That's what it is. That's what really happens.
It's funny because, like, the wealthy have this Hobbesian view of what's going to happen in a state of anarchy but poor people, they have more of a, it's actually more utopian, or sort of that everyone would share, you know, it turns into Burning Man until the wealthy show up with their guns. And that it's, this film is also to me like an indictment against like libertarianism, because if you say, well, we're all free to do whatever we want, then the people with money are going to still be able to amass a private army.
Yeah, it's the illusion of a level playing field, which is, I think, what always goes into libertarianism. It's this idea that, you know, it's like the invisible hand. No, the government intervenes to give multinational corporations some hookups, right? And in this case, no, the rich people are able to buy protection or buy their way out of participating in a way that poor people can't. But what I saw The Purge,
the first Purge.
It's the most recent one, right? It's the prequel?
Yes. Yes,
okay, it's I saw the prequel, that one. But... And it's with Marissa Tomei.
Love Marissa Tomei.
Yeah, she's great.
Love her.
She went to Kinderland to comic camp.
How about that?
Yeah. Van Jones is in it. Has a nice cameo in it.
Yes.
Van Jones.
As Van Jones.
As Van Jones. Van Jones as himself. Starring Van Jones as himself. It's interesting what you said about how it looks like a right-wing film. Because it almost, I mean, it comes off at the beginning. It seems almost like blaxploitation.
Yeah.
Like a blaxploitation film, right? And like one of the earliest characters is a guy named Skeletor. Not to be confused
Skeletor.
With Tom Perez, DNC chair Tom Perez, who has his own Skeletor look. It is subversive because at first glance, it looks like it's just like, oh, look at this movie about all these crazy, violent black people. And then you learn that, like, as you were saying, Leslie, there isn't this natural embrace of violence. It's actually that they send in Blackwater.
Blackwater.
Type.
Their logo is pretty much Blackwater.
They all ex-military. Something funky going down, D.
They send in all these mercenaries because none of the regular folk, they're just having parties. They're just hanging out. So they have to send in these Blackwater people to go and basically slaughter black and brown people across Long Island. The ones
Staten
who
Island.
Couldn't afford to leave. Staten Island, no. Excuse me.
Don't be islandist, Leslie.
who couldn't afford to leave or accepted the $5,000 payment to participate in the experiment. This was the first purge, so it was framed as an experiment, and they offered people $5,000 to participate, which I thought was really powerful in the film because in almost no other movie is $5,000 presented as like life-changing. But that's what the characters in here actually meant. Talk about. And I feel like most white people in America wouldn't consider $5,000 life-changing, but it would be to a lot of black and brown people.
Right.
And poor people, that's explicitly mentioned in this film. And in contrast to all the films where like every character is like an ad executive or works in publishing.
Right.
And like we're inundated with these films of people who live in New York with these massive apartments and they can just fly back and forth around the country to break up and make up with their boyfriends and
right.
girlfriends.
Every rom-com has a main character that's an architect who's dating a publisher.
Who has the time and resources to intervene a plane when it's about to leave. It's interesting because I was going to say when you said that, Leslie, it's like, yeah, usually it would have to be $1 million. But then it's like one of those things where it's not even about the amount of money, right? It's like the quality and quantity issue. Like there's a difference between a life where you need to do something. In other words, it's not like whatever $5,000 is for someone much richer, it doesn't serve the same purpose. Like, because it's in one case, it's life changing, right? Like let's say $5,000 is the same percentage of your wealth. Whatever the equivalent is for a rich person, it doesn't serve the same function because your needs are already being met.
Yeah, exactly. So there's no amount of money you could get, you know, a well-off person to participate in a purge if they don't want to. And that's kind of explicitly pointed out in all the films, because what we see in film and film again, you know, the suburbs, they lock down, they build themselves fortresses unless they want to participate in it. But people in the cities, people in the apartments, people in the hood, like they just get slaughtered. Like they have no means to protect themselves, and they don't have the means to participate in the purge if they want to. Like there's a scene, and I believe the second or third film, where you know the creepy neighbor tries to assault a woman, but then he's come along. But then like a mercenary comes along and just shoots him in the head. It's like, no, the purge isn't for this poor Hispanic violent guy. It's for, you know, the wealthy and the people who have some. Even if you're a bad person who happens to be poor, the purge isn't for you either.
The ultimate goal is it's a very calculated way to cull the poor and the working class.
And they say this in the film. They explicitly say this in these films, in these popular mainstream films. They say that the government is trying to kill off all the black and poor people.
If you look at, you know, capitalism always needs a workforce. And they need a workforce, but they need to have a surplus of workers who are unemployed to keep wages down and to keep everybody in competition. Like this
divide
is,
and conquer. And
yeah, this is a way, the purge is like just the way to keep, to regulate the population.
There's a scene where Marissa Tomei like finds out what they are up to. Right. She realizes she's like a psychiatrist or psychologist. Marissa
yeah,
Tomei.
She's kind of. So Marissa Tomei's character is interesting because she's not really, because she is a true believer in this, but like just her science is bunk. And she's being used by the ruling party to give an excuse to call the population. It's like, so her character is kind of strange because like you're supposed to, like, because she comes up with the purge, but she does it for like pure reasons. Like she actually thinks that this will improve society.
We are here with Dr. May Updale. She came up with this experiment. Is the purge a political device?
It is a psychological one. If we want to save our country, we must release all our anger in one night.
If everybody can just, you know, like purge all their negative emotions. But she is a true scientist. She didn't, she was upset when she saw that
it required
the numbers were being,
were being cooked.
You're sending soldiers into the island disguised as citizens.
This country needs for this to work.
So
yeah,
she's kind of
experience.
I was just thinking, she just reminds me of like anybody that believes in the meritocracy.
Yeah.
Or sort of like a neoliberal, like I went to the best school. I went to Harvard. I'm a Chicago boy. I studied economics. Like, let's go and take these ideas and impose them on a poor population and see what happens.
Yeah, it's like a what are the progressives, but not like capital P progressives, like the very paternalistic, helping the poor, but in a pathologizing way, obviously.
Let's sterilize them.
Yeah,
so that they don't have a lot of
to
kids.
To protect them from themselves, right?
Yeah.
This hurts me more than it hurts you. But it's interesting because, or she also reminded me kind of a libertarian, like a combo of a libertarian, like humanitarian interventionist or something, who... Because the idea is that, like you were saying, Leslie, she's a true believer because she believes that people really do want a purge. So you can see that from her perspective. It's a kind of Machiavellian thing, but you can see from her perspective, it's like on a cost-benefit analysis. If people need to purge and you're providing them with this outlet, you can see how that's a good thing. But what she learns, right, is that people on their own aren't doing this, and it requires these like Blackwater mercenary types or just people who are paid. Like there's a range, right? Like kind of low level random John Doe's who do it for the money, or there are like high level trained military types who do it.
Yes.
And when she sees that that's required, it kind of changes her, the framework of it, because it's no longer providing this kind of needed service for catharsis. It's actually creating the need for it. And she gets very upset. And then she learns, you know, that the point of this is to, as you were saying, Gabe, wipe out a population. Like the guy from the, what's it, the NF is, I
the
guess.
The New Founding Fathers.
Yeah, the New Founding. And
the Republicans.
Yes, the Republicans. they are like, no, we're overpopulated. So obviously we have to get rid of some of the population. Which is, it's interesting because like a lot of people, even liberals, think that the issue is that we're overpopulated as opposed to the issue is like the distribution of resources and wealth.
Yeah. The one knock against the politics of the first purge, and I don't really think it's really fair to hold them accountable for it, is that there's no one pushes back against the statement of overpopulation. But it does come from like the fascist ruling party.
Right.
So
yeah. It's kind of implicitly, right? Like rejected. Yeah. It's not explicitly, like there's no lecture about the distribution of resources, but we could do that. We should make a trailer for like the purge explainer, a Vox explainer from about purge. So you just mentioned, by the way, you just said Republicans. So this is shifting gears a little bit, but it's kind of related. You're someone who was like a proudly Bernie or bust, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Pretty much, yeah.
So what is I was having this discussion with someone the other day, and it's like, I think that there's a difference between Republicans and Democrats. But it's not a big enough difference. And, you know, I noted you said they're Republicans, right? You didn't say that they're just like neolibs or part of the duopoly. But how do you hold those two ideas in your head at the same time? They're not that contradictory. I'm just curious what your kind of vision of it is as someone who thinks a lot about this and someone who's like viciously critical of the Democrats and you were an open Jill Stein supporter, right?
Yeah.
Which is not like a, it's not like a, obviously we had her on the show, Jill Stein. I'm just curious what your view of all of this stuff is.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, there's no Jill Stein in the Purge universe. They actually, they're in the third movie. They have a Hillary Clinton type figure, and it's the movie with the worst politics because it's very like reformist.
Right.
And there's kind of hints at the end of the film that like that actually is not effective. It doesn't stop, you know, the fascists. Like I just said that they were Republicans because that's what the party is basically. There is a kind of like a Democratic Party in the Purge universe who wants to stop the Purge, but like I think Matt Chrisman came up with a when he was on our show came up with a brilliant concept for it. Like what you should actually see instead of her, like she would, you know, cancel the Purge, but then they would just start repealing like different aspects of the anti-Purge law until it comes all the way back, just like the ACA. That's probably what would really happen, because there is like an armed revolutionary force in the Purge universe, and they all get killed because of the Democrat, basically, because of Hillary Clinton during the course of the film.
So they're neutered by the moderates, right?
Yes.
Which we see time and time again, yeah. And what, you know, Leslie, in case listeners don't know, we first met online. Leslie created this Bernie Made Me White hashtag, which was very funny, but also very important. Do you still get a lot of, you know...
It's getting called white.
Being called white, yeah. And has that changed at all? Like, do you always get that? Has the tenor of that conversation changed? Or is it still like you are to the left of Hillary? You are either self-loathing or white and pretending not to be white?
I don't know. I feel like I somehow fell out of that Twitter. I'm not sure how. It wasn't deliberate. So I don't quite get the... I don't get like a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters like jumping in my mentions anymore. I just haven't been interactive. I don't know if they all blocked me.
Right.
But it's been a few months since I've had a good scrap with any of them. So, but I don't think they've gotten any better. If I think that's a better answer to your question, I don't, because obviously Bree still deals with it. And there's this one kind of prominent Black writer who writes about race a lot. Who, when it comes to anything dealing with class, like she just has no concept up and has kind of admitted this, but still wants to lecture the left about talking about class too much instead of just race, which is just bizarre, unhelpful, and like useless. Like, you know, you can't just, I mean, like the big thing to this week was some student came out with a paper that proved that Trump voters voted for Trump because they're racist. And I'm like, you've been saying for decades that all white people are racist.
Right.
So what's the news there? Like, yes, white people who voted for Trump were racist. So were the white people who voted for Hillary Clinton. So were the white people who voted for Barack Obama. That's not an excuse for losing to Donald Trump. If Barack Obama could win over enough of the racist votes to win, so should Hillary Clinton have. She should have done the same thing. I mean, as a racist herself, she should have had an easier time to win over the votes of some segment of white racists than Barack Obama did.
How unpopular do you have to be to alienate your own base of racists?
Yeah, I just don't get that. Sort of that apologia for, and it's just like, did you see that even Broad City has said like, no, Hillary Clinton should not run again?
Oh,
like,
good. Wow.
We have to leave that in the past. If your plan is to run a candidate who can't do better than Hillary Clinton, who can't learn from her mistakes, then your plan is to lose.
Leslie, I found my Halloween costume, man. It's a zombie Hillary 2020.
Yeah.
Oh, so, yes.
That's the ghost of Hillary keeps coming back.
Yeah. True horror story is the idea of Hillary Clinton running again.
Talk about 2020 in a minute. Do you want to run again?
No.
Wait.
No.
That was a pause.
Well, I'd like to be president.
Okay.
Because it, at the in her, you know, 2016 campaign was a zombie campaign. Right. This is, you know, things that she has said and her own campaign have said themselves that they never had a message for why she was running.
We have confused everybody in the world, including ourselves. And we have confused our friends and our enemies. So the work would be work that I feel very well prepared for, having been in the Senate for 8 years, having been a diplomat in the State Department. And
like she was just a lifeless corpse walking around running for president because she had run for president before and had been running for president for the past, you know, 20 years, basically, since Bill Clinton left White House. It was just, you know, this corpse being automated by this one desire. But instead of brains, it was president. And like, you know, people didn't want to vote for the zombie. People didn't want to come out and vote for the zombie.
Yeah, they're zombophobic. It's not even misogyny. It's anti-zombieism.
If you're choosing between like the Frankenstein and the zombie, you're always going to go with the Frankenstein.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's a really good metaphor, actually, because you're saying like the Frankenstein has a personality.
At least the Frankenstein has a personality.
He's cobbled one together.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I think her slogans being, her unofficial slogans are perfect, which are, ready for Hillary, and I'm with her. Like the most substance-free, value-free, like just hagiographical, biographical thing.
Well, they can now start taking like a Friday the 13th sequel titles, like Hillary Lives.
Yeah.
Or Hillary X.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hillary Takes Manhattan.
Follow that, Hillary. Throw in some Big Bird.
It follows.
Yeah, I know. That's really scary. By the way, speaking of nightmares, you saw that she was interviewed by, I think, someone at The Guardian about, of course, because Me Too is still relevant and the Clintons are still traveling around and doing their thing. And someone asked about Monica Lewinsky and and whether the relationship between Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky was an abuse of power.
There are people who look at the incidents of the 90s and they say a president of the United States cannot have a consensual relationship with an intern. The power imbalance is too great.
Who was an adult. But let me ask you this. Where's the investigation of the current incumbent against whom numerous allegations have been made and which he dismisses, denies, and ridicules? So there was an investigation, and it, as I believe, came out in the right place.
And in retrospect, do you think Bill should have resigned, President Clinton should have resigned in the 90s in the wake of the Monica Lewinsky scandal?
Absolutely not.
So it wasn't an abuse of power?
No.
And her response was no, she was an adult. Which I feel like that's just a really bad answer. Like, I really expected her to have some line from Bill Clinton that was some kind of dodge. Like, it was a long time ago, blah, 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 blah. But that, to me, and I don't really get how her supporters can, like, stand by that. Because you can't really talk yourself out of defining a relationship between the most powerful man on the entire planet, who would be the president of the United States, and a 22-year-old intern. If that's not an abuse of power, I think that's kind of a charitable read, right? There are other people who are like, well, what kind of consent do you have when it's that dynamic? But to be charitable, it's an abuse of power, right? Like, don't anyone who's not a misogynist or whose love of Hillary and Bill Clinton doesn't denature them and distort them into like just hateful beasts would have to admit that there is an abuse of power there.
This is all just tribalism. She's defending Bill because that's what the Clintons do. They defend themselves.
Yeah.
People who like Hillary will defend her while at the same time being just as being rightfully, you know, angry at someone like Kavanaugh,
right,
or Clarence Thomas for similar things. Like, it's not about like logic or what's right.
Well, did you see Bill Clinton's response to that when Craig Melvin on MSNBC asked him about it?
Was this when he was doing his book tour?
Yes, exactly.
Looking back on what happened then through the lens of Me Too now, do you think differently? Or feel more responsibility?
No, I felt terrible then. And I came to grips with it.
Did you ever apologize to
him? No, yes, and nobody believes that I got out of that for free. I left the White House $16 million in debt. But you typically have ignored gaping facts in describing this, and I bet you don't even know them.
Oh, yeah, I did see that one. That one is so good.
It's so
James
good.
Because James Patterson was there, and because they were supposed to be doing the book together.
Yeah.
Neither Bill Clinton nor James Patterson wrote a single word of that book.
Oh, really?
James Patterson has a team of writers.
Okay.
So James Patterson is sitting there. He thought, like, oh, this was just going to be some easy money. I tell my team of writers to write from Bill Clinton's perspective. I get to go on tour with the former president of the United States. And that's where he ends up, just sitting there completely baffled and uncomfortable and ignored for a book because he didn't write a book with this man. It's amazing.
He didn't even write it, yeah. Well, it's funny, and he's like, that's a long time ago. Like, he tries to defend him.
I think this thing has been, it's 20 years ago. Come on, let's talk about JFK. Let's talk about, you know, LBJ. Stop already.
He's like annoyed that he's being asked about that. But that's funny. He didn't even write it. Poor guy. It's really funny because I'm looking at a photo right now of Bill and James Patterson, and he has his hands like, it looks like he's like showing Bill Clinton what a woman's large breasts look like. He's kind of making looks like he is cupping something. And of course, in the actual novel, there's like a description of a woman's breasts, which they refer to as girls. Like a woman's girls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did a reading of like the first couple of chapters, and it's so bizarre. It's so bizarre. Like, I still don't know why nobody has mentioned that in the novel that Bill Clinton wrote, and you know, kind of about himself, his wife is dead. She died. What? It's like an SNL skit of what Bill Clinton would have done after he left the White House. This is like, he actually did that. Hillary Clinton is dead in the book that Bill Clinton wrote about himself. That is amazing.
That is pretty good. Yeah, I wonder if she cared about that. She was probably if I did it.
I know he had a conversation with her, and I know he smooth talked her into
it. Hey, well, baby, look, I just think it'd be best for both of us if you weren't in this book. I mean, for your own political aspirations. Hey, I'm doing this for you. You've got to be 6 feet in the grave before you can become Zombie Hillary 2020.
Yeah, exactly. Before the rebirth.
Now, look, this story is going to need some romance in it, and the only way that's going to happen is if you're out of the picture.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, speaking of dead wives, I think we all watched a really great movie. About a wife who ended up dead by the end, unfortunately.
We don't know. Were they common law? Common law wife?
Good
civil
question.
Partnership?
Good question.
Roommates, lovers, Mandy.
To hear us discuss Mandy, the Nicolas Cage movie, with Leslie Lee, and to hear our chat about Ronald Reagan, hippie punching, and Lionel Roach's penis, please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. That bonus episode will be ready by the end of the week. You'll also get to hear us play another round of Would You Rather Desert Island. This time we answer whether we would rather be stuck on a desert island for the rest of our lives with Donald Trump or Ronald Reagan. And of course, you get all sorts of goodies and bonus episodes and extended interviews when you support our Patreon. But don't go anywhere. We have a special announcement from Leslie Lee coming up.
Well, great. Anything else you want to make sure we mention, we talk about?
Let me just give me one second. Pull up a calendar. See if you might get an exclusive announcement. Okay. So I want to exclusively announce that Struggle Session will be doing a live show, our very first, in Los Angeles.
Yay.
On Monday, November 19th, Monday night.
Awesome.
All the information will be available at strugglesession.us or on our Twitter feed /strugglesesh. We'll have, you know, exclusive merchandise there. We'll have a live show. We'll have an opening act.
Wow.
All kinds of good stuff. So make sure, you know, save the date. Monday, November 19th in Los Angeles.
That resident.
And just quickly tell us about this 31 Days of Horror thing you're doing.
Oh, yeah. So this is second year running. We just picked 31 horror movies that we liked, and we're kind of watching them and talking about them with our listeners and doing episodes on them. And we're actually going to have a special guest to come on and talk to us about The Devil's Backbone and the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah, that's me.
Yes, Katie Halper is going to be on Struggle Session. It may be a bonus episode.
I'm not sure yet. So I won't feel friend zoned, bonus zoned.
Your paywall content.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've broken the paywall. Leslie, remind people where we can find you.
Patreon.com/strugglesession @LeslieLeeIII.
Great. Gabe.
Hey, what's up? You guys can find me @Gabe_Pacheco on Twitter.
And I'm KT Halps, letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. And the hashtag for this is KT Halps Show, letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S-H-O-W. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can rate and review us. You can find us on SoundCloud. You can find us on Facebook. And Leslie, you were at one of our first live tapings. Speaking of live tapings. So you got to get back to New York.
Yes, I do. I do got to get back. Anytime, just give me a heads
up. Leslie was a guest. It was actually called the Burning Made Me White taping. And then you came back to another one, and you, one of our famous karaoke after parties, which we have to do again. And you did...
Yes.
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
I did Under Pressure.
Under Pressure?
I did Under Pressure.
Didn't you also do a Rolling Stone song like...
Oh, yeah, I Miss You. I miss you.
You see?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a coming full circle. We miss you. You have to come back.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I want to come back.
Yeah. Awesome.
I've been hanging out so long. I've been sleeping all alone. Lord, I miss you.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.